The span of our lives, from youth to the present, is filled with stories and challenges that shape us. And today we visit two performers who are also authors and tell us about the fiber of their work and lives. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. Candy Milo is a singer and a successful voice artist who creates many characters, but it was her upbringing in the world of halfway houses that shaped her. Yes, she was a resident, but only because her dad ran the place. Her memoir is Surviving the Odd, and we'll talk with her in just a minute. Later on, we visit professional storyteller, author, and poet Lauren Neamy with his book, A Breviary for the Lost, Poems for the During and After. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Candy Milo has been a performer for most of her life, following in the footsteps of her dad, Tony Milo, who was a singer and entertainer, until at one point he gave it all up to open Milo Arms, a halfway house that housed developmentally disabled and emotionally disturbed adults who in the late 60s and 1970s were being released from institutional settings during the years of Reagan and Nixon. It was a real left turn for the entire family. Tony Milo had five kids to support, and Candy tells the story of her unusual family life that included most of the people who became residents of Milo Arms in her memoir, Surviving the Odd. Candy is a singer, an actor, and she is a voiceover actor that you probably have heard in film and TV as she's voiced many characters for Looney Tunes and was the voice of Dexter in Dexter's Laboratory. She shares her life story to advocate for the mentally ill. Her characterizations of her family and the residents they tend are funny, at times irreverent, and at times heartbreaking. Let's listen to our conversation. Candy Milo.
Yes.
I'm so happy to talk to you today about this book, Surviving the Odd.
Thank you. It's quite a journey to get here.
Well, before we get into your book and the story you tell there, some of our listeners may actually know you, but maybe not by your name, but by a character you have voiced. So first, tell us a little bit about your career as a voiceover artist and how did you get into that? And maybe some of the characters that people might know you from or things you might have appeared in.
Absolutely. So I actually grew up in San Jose, California, and I did a lot of children's music theater and always wanted to be a singer. That's what I wanted to do. And, you know, I'm an odd girl, so I was very specific about what kind of a singer I wanted to be. And what I wanted to be was a backup singer for Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert was an instrumental guy that had very few singer hits, but I decided that I wanted to sing sort of a 60s, 70s jazz. And so I moved to LA very young. I did a couple years at Santa Clara University, pre-law, as my father wanted, and then moved to Los Angeles by the time I think I was 19. And I was singing at open mic nights in West Hollywood, and somebody heard me and took me under their wing, and they passed away during the AIDS crisis. And at their memorial, I sang, and someone walked up to me that had been this person's assistant and said, "I think Aaron would want me to represent you." And I looked and it said cartoons and commercials. And I thought, is that what my singing did for you? You thought of cartoons and commercials? And that was really it. And I started on Tiny Toons. Steven Spielberg actually hired me for that. And Sweetie Bird sounds a little bit like this. And then I moved on. I've been doing it. That was 1988. I'm Dexter from Dexter's Laboratory. Dee Dee, get out in the laboratory. I'm Cheese and Coco and Madam Foster from Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends, Mrs. Wakeman from My Life as a Teenage Robot, Snap and Bull Nerd from Chalk Zone, Nick Dean and many others from Jimmy Neutron. And I just spent my life at Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon. I'm a Saturday morning girl. But lately, the last thing that I've done is I've taken over the voice of Granny for the late June Foray. And I did that in Space Jam 2, and I've done it on all the Looney Tunes shorts. As long as Warner Brothers will have me, I will be doing it. So that's kind of where I sit, and I've always wanted to be a singer.
And we are going to talk about your book. Don't worry about that. But two things. Are you still singing? Do you still have singing gigs?
I do, like, actually, I do regional theater here in Los Angeles. Last year, I did Mamma Mia, which was the most fun because I am of the age where ABBA was my high school jam, and it's the most fun. I have an audition on Thursday for a really great role in Ragtime. I do open mics sometimes, but I contracted COVID in July. Just I had had a hormonal imbalance and it dropped my immune system. And I was at a political fundraiser without a mask during dinner, and I caught it, and it gave me COVID-induced asthma. So it's very hard for me still. This was July. It's very hard for me still to take a very deep singing breath, but I'm battling through it, and they think it's another 3 or 4 months of this. And so I am going to go on Thursday and see what comes out of the old pipes. But I think I do get hired, Suzanne, because I'm tiny and I have this big Ethel Merman sounding voice, and so I think people think it's kind of odd and funny that this 5'1" person belts her brains out. So I do, and I miss it, but thank goodness it hasn't interrupted my ability to speak and do cartoon voices. I'd be sunk. I really would. It's was quite a journey.
Yeah, and a lesson for many of us.
Many wear a mask. The three of us who contracted COVID at that event, and it was just like a horrible thing. So I just carry one wherever I go, and it's long lasting. I think they still don't know everything that it can do, and it stays in. But right now I'm just very positive about it. Like, I'm just pressing forward, pressing forward as if we're going to plow through.
And the other question I want to ask, and for our listeners, the book is about Candy's growing up in a board and care home, or around a board and care home for emotionally disturbed and mentally challenged or intellectually challenged individuals. And I guess I'm just wondering if that environment, and certainly growing up around your dad, Tony Milo, who was the quintessential entertainer. But I mean, did that somehow feed into your whole cartoon character voice ability? Just being around this population of people. And I mean, you describe one of the residents, Dennis, as talking like Elmer Fudd. And so in some odd way, did that contribute to your abilities there?
Thank you so much, Suzanne. This is such a great question, and it's been a burning question. And who seems to get this of the readers that have contacted me on social media are my reading audience on the spectrum. And the more autistic or developmentally challenged that they are, the more they understand that my characters are not based on any of the residents' voices, but to be exposed to something other than mainstream from a very young age. I was 7 when my dad got the idea. I was 8 by the time he acquired the property, and 8 and a half when he got the residents from the local hospitals. And we lived in the house with them for about a year, and then we moved next door. And I think that my characterizations and the way that I approach material and the things that pop into my mind are different than anybody else's. I don't think I have extraordinary ability, but what I have is a broad understanding of the human spectrum and the human reaction to things. And I think when you were describing who was in our board and care home, which back then they called a halfway house, because it was a halfway point between institutionalization and then independent living. And I think that I saw a real childlike, not childish, but a childlike wonder about the world and a childlike trust of my father and the system. And I approach the material when I audition across any discipline, commercials, everything. I just come at it from a completely different angle. I've been this way my entire life. When people audition for musicals, they watch YouTube videos. I let the material speak to me and I wonder what a Dennis or a Marvin or a Pedro or a Toomey or Nancy, what they would think about this. And it's just because I've been exposed to, you know, as I say in my book, lemons. And so I know how to make a different kind of lemonade.
Yes, yes. Well, your dad, Tony Milo.
Yes.
He was an entertainer before he got into running Milo Arms, mm-hmm. the halfway house. And so tell us about your dad and his career. I think in the book you might have characterized him as a B-list entertainer, but he had a career in showbiz before he moved into social work, let's say. So talk about your dad, the entertainer, Tony Milo.
My father, Tony Milo, he was found by Gus Edwards, who was an impresario in the mid-20s. He was in vaudeville, and he had an operatic tenor voice at 6 years old. So by 1924 and 25, he was performing in Nickelodeons. He moved on to nightclubs, and then he took jobs with the USO, and he was in Germany and as a young man and did nightclubs. Well, what happened in the 1950s? So if my dad is born in 1918, by the 1950s, he's an old man, but he had done the Sullivan Show and he had done so many things. But with the advent of TV, nightclubs were dying, because why would you go out when you could watch it on TV? You could watch Jack Parr and you could watch everything. So nightclubs were dying out. The USO became volunteer where it used to pay. And my dad had five kids. So he was, according to my older brother, which I did not know this, my dad was delivering flowers and doing whatever he could do to support his family. And his last tour was 67 in Vietnam. And I hadn't seen my dad. I was 5 or 6. I hadn't seen my dad for 18 months. So to be in show business, to be sending money home, to not make a lot of money, he was really looking for something else to do. And by the time the 60s happened, he had been in show business for 40 years and he grew tired of it. But what I found when my mother passed away at a very old age, 95 last year, was a box that had 11 letters from the state government from 1941 to 1946, thanking my father and commending him for his show for what they called soldiers who were shell-shocked, and hospital shows and stateside hospital shows and disabled children. And my father was constantly giving back to society, whether that's because he came from a family of 13 kids in New York. I mean, I don't know, but I discovered that he had had a lifelong connection to those that are differently enabled. And I think that was a natural progression. Now, Suzanne, I will be honest, and for your listeners, this was not an easy transition. This literally broke his heart, because when I contracted COVID and I couldn't speak very well and I couldn't take a deep breath and I couldn't get my voice up, I kept thinking, what if it's my turn to leave show business at around, you know, the same age? What if it's my turn to find something else to do. And, you know, my mom kept pushing him to get up and sing. And I mean, I have recordings of him at 60, 61, where he sounded unbelievable, a big, huge Tom Jones kind of sound. And that's the arc of it. He was hugely famous as a child, working with the Gum Sisters, which was Judy Garland's family, and Liberace and Ethel Merman, and then had this long nightclub career. And then it was over. And it was over.
Yes. Well, you say in the book, Tony Milo was a born entertainer, and Milo Arms Borden Care was his new nightclub. And it seems like, as you describe it in the book, that he did a lot of shtick and brought that into his relationships with the residents, and that also seemed to be part of his success with the residents, though maybe not necessarily with the, bureaucratic establishment. So talk about this professional shift in his life, and by extension, yours.
Yeah, the house that we bought was a converted fraternity house, and he borrowed from Peter to pay Paul. He borrowed from in-laws to get this house, and it had a PA system that was left in the property. And it was where he called people to dinner, or he called people down for medication, or he called people down to the phone or to meet their social worker. But he would do like 5 minutes, and he'd play Spike Jones, and he'd play music, and he'd play Mantovani, and then he'd fade out. It was truly, when I saw Suzanne, Good Morning Vietnam, my heart stopped. I thought, that was my dad. And I think that the care that our residents had gotten in hospitals and in institutions was not personalized, where they knew their names, but they knew them more by their diagnoses. And my father knew them by their idiosyncrasies. That's what he would hone in on. That's why I know about Pedro collecting buffalo head nickels. That's why I know about Marvin and his sort of autistic bend towards Western movies. And he spoke all the lines from Westerns. And that's how I knew them, because my dad zeroed in on that and celebrated it. And I think what they wanted most of all was to be seen and feel like they would be cared for. And it should not go unnoticed. One of the most important lines that I write in my book is that my dad wanted them to be able to tell a joke, not just be the butt of a joke, you know? And he would do knock knocks before Daryl Cooper, the party pooper, who was in love with me, that's a whole other thing, that he would get Daryl to tell knock knock jokes. And Jimmy Fitzgerald was a joke teller and a mimic. It was just one of those where my mom went to, they opened a Kmart, which was a huge thing in San Jose. And my mom went there and bought everybody black slacks and white shirts so that they had a uniform and they looked presentable when they went outside of our home. But I swear to you, I say, they looked like waiters aboard a cruise ship. But that was part of my dad's deal, where he bought them socks and shoes and pants and shirt so that they were not the targets when they walked out, without realizing that all the college students around San Jose State University knew exactly whose home they were out of because they looked like waiters. He just had this thing where these were his troops. They were under his command, and he had this wicked, wicked, wicked sense of humor that just kind of never stopped. And by extension, I do, because I've done stuff. I have a grown daughter, Gabby, and when she was really little, I would point to weird people out the window and go, "There's your boyfriend," and she would be so upset. And I thought, oh, sorry, you didn't have my dad. You don't have the sarcasm gene yet. I'll wait until you're a little bit older than four to point out your boyfriend. And I just think that is how I live my life now. I wouldn't say that I'm not serious. I'm not an unserious person, but I do let things flow because I think stuff is going to happen whether we like it or not. And we're a little bit powerless over things. And I think everybody needs to laugh. But I think that's kind of in a nutshell how I was brought up, how I saw problem solving. And I think the government didn't know what to do because he was gaining popularity without having a background, and they didn't want him to have too much power,
right,
too much say-so, you know?
And this was in the 1970s when,
yes,
Ronald Reagan was governor and Richard Nixon was president, and there was this deinstitutionalizing thrust for the care of many people who did not have the skills to live independently. And I think the implications of that period are still afflicting us today in how mental health is approached.
Yes.
And you talk about it in the book and have no kind words for either one of those men.
I don't, because it was a reach for both of them for power, that Reagan knew that he could cinch his place in history and was moving. And he was backed by incredibly powerful people from the Republican Party. And I only say this, I don't demonize the party. My father was a lifelong Republican until the day he died. He was a Republican. I'm born on Richard Nixon's birthday. I was a big fan. I'm telling you, these are the facts. And the facts are that he was making a play for senator and then presidential. And he knew that if he could balance the state's budget, and he did so on the backs of people who didn't vote. And what they did was there was the Lantern and Prentice Act, which disallowed discrimination. But what that did was make you equal. So if you were equal, why were you institutionalized? And Ronald Reagan and the team behind him were so clever that they got the ACLU involved with this deinstitutionalization by saying, if there was one person, the purity test, which we still see today, if there is one person there against their will, then everybody should go. And, you know, it, as I say in the book, it wasn't a great place to live, but they didn't take into account the people who had been institutionalized since adolescence. So they literally were waiting for a lunch bell to ring. They wandered the streets. And here we are some, you know, 50 years later, we have generational houselessness. We have generational, we are used to it. If somebody that is homeless, houseless, is on the street and talking to a fire hydrant, it paints a brushstroke to everybody. And we don't do anything to help the homeless, which I think Karen Bass is really, in Los Angeles, is really taking the reins on this, because we assume they're all mentally ill or they're all mentally deficient. That's why young people are living on the street. You know, they're drug addicts or they're this. It has nothing to do with socioeconomics and being unable to afford rent. So I think that you still have the stigmatization of the homeless as being mentally ill, as if that is something that they can control and that there's something that they're at fault with, you know? And I think I see it now, and this is why the focus changed. I'd first written a draft of this maybe 15 years ago, got my feelings hurt and put it aside. It was also 500 pages and a lot of jokes because I didn't want to look at my father. I didn't want to look at that relationship for fear of him being a faulty hero. And now that I see what he was trying to do and how he called it, he called this, that I felt compelled to write out how I survived being around these people, and everybody deserves a chance to be housed. Everybody, no matter, you know, if they have change coins in their pocket and they're jangling them all day long, it doesn't matter what your idiosyncrasies are. Everybody deserves to be housed.
And your dad, as you depict him in the book, is, and thank you for mentioning that, because I was going to ask you about, you know, the process of writing the book, because there is a lot of humor in the book that I think you're representing your dad's real driving personality through the book. I mean, I feel you're channeling him in a way. Also, you do, without going into depth, comment on his drinking or mm-hmm. his brusqueness with people and even with you at times. I mean, Candy, you were a little kid, and it seemed like in some ways you were your dad's sidekick, that there was responsibility put on you, or you were put in a position as, you know, an 8-9-year-old of being responsible for things that maybe you were, in essence, too young to fully absorb. So, and I think you do represent that in the book, and the very title of your book is Surviving, that you survived that. But it also stigmatized you when you were growing up and you're just trying to fit in. And kids are cruel. People are cruel. Mm-hmm. So how did you manage? And you were a smart mm-hmm. girl, intelligent girl, skipping grades, but also changing schools a lot. And so so how did you come out of that, Candy?
Suzanne, I'm sending you heart-shaped hands. I was his sidekick, and I don't think that he could go to my mom for emotional support because she didn't get how he could give up show business for this. She truly, and till the day she died at 95, she couldn't get how he could do this. And I got it because I was a witness in the office. But I think that, you know, I don't like this, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. But I never took anything personally that my dad did. My dad was a rat packer in the 40s and 50s. He owned nightclubs, he drank at nightclubs. And then by the time he was in his 50s, he had undiagnosed diabetes. And he just simply could not drink like he was accustomed to doing. And as it hit him harder, earlier, quicker, faster, that's when he realized he was addicted. And he couldn't not have 2 or 3 drinks in the cocktail hour and wine with dinner. And the frustration of the government, local, state, city, county, federal, coming down and the rules changing and him being invited to sing and get up, and me and 5 kids, and at this time, probably 40 residents. We had moved to a bigger facility. And I think it all came barreling down on him, and he became a father figure rather than a father. Like, he was always warm and gracious, but he was that New York Italian guy that you didn't hug a lot. You couldn't go to him and talk to him about any personal issues because he'd go to school and hit somebody, you know? And I found, because while my perspective is so huge with the kind of people I grew up with, I didn't have a normal upbringing. So it wasn't until I got to high school and started to go out with girls that I realized that their fathers finished at 5 and came home and nobody drank at the dinner table. And, you know, that everybody was very boring and normal. And people's fathers were doctors and lawyers and dentists and grocers. And I was like, oh my God, this is so different than what I knew. And I think what I did was I went inside and I went into an imagination and I just powered through life. And I think that I just celebrate the fact that I now bridge both worlds. I have stopped the behavior in the generation for my daughter that my father had that was not positive. I think that surviving was digging deep for inner strength, knowing that my canoe was my canoe, it was going down my path, and I was going to do whatever I could do to be in show business. And it's why at my age, I burst into a room. I let people know I'm there. I have a big voice. I am there. I'm constantly trying to tell everybody, you have to see me. You have to listen to me. And I think that's one of the kind of negatives No, it's a big negative. It's my constant need to prove myself and that somebody sees my talent rather than just my energy, you know?
Well, what I saw also as a major theme of the book, and you're touching on it right here, is respect and a yearning for respect and a lack of respect at sometimes. Mm-hmm. And this would go for your dad and his life, but also by extension to the lives of the residents. And it seemed like that was something that your dad kind of insisted upon. And so I saw that as a major theme in the book, kind of demanding respect for who you are.
Again, so insightful. Thank you. As I had said, in an institution, you are known by your diagnosis. And my father wanted to treat an entire human being. And I think there were many instances, but I talk about one where a physician handling a person said the medication that they take is not really for them. Lithium, Thorazine, very raw dosage. Very new drugs. You know, we have so many other drugs people can take now, but back then those were the major antipsychotics, and it was to make the general public feel comfortable. That had nothing to do with the residents or helping them. They were considered, it makes me very emotional, they were considered lost causes. They were done. They were just going for checkups. They were out. They were lost causes. It was my dad's problem now. And my dad saw them as his kids. Now, we also had five kids and we were kind of treated equally. But I also say in the book that my dad expected more of us. And one of the things that I don't like that it brought out in me was that I was put in charge, but I, at a very young age, was an authority. And I think that that's how I kept emotionally and psychologically safe, is that I had to know best, and I had to recognize, and I had to see if somebody was off their meds, and I had to see if somebody was dangerous, and I was an emotional and psychological lookout. And I'm tired, like I'm right now, I'm tired, Suzanne. But I think that it has served me well in a very rough industry known as show business, and kept me kind of safe and on the straight and narrow. I want to write a second book called I Should Be Dead By Now, because I really should be, but I think Dennis Rodman has that title, so I'm upset. But I think I think that that's the lack of respect that most would see was my dad coming from a big family where everybody had a job to do. That's how he grew up. You were a kid and you had a job to do to support the family. So my older brother and I have discussed that my dad wanted him to take over, and he said, hell no. I mean, absolutely not. He's 7 years older than I am, and he went into IT and got out of there. And I think that my dad was looking hard at me, Suzanne, and I was like, I have bigger plans. I'm also going to do show business and then probably peter out and work with the homeless, but not until I'm way into my 60s. And I think he knew he had lost me when I wanted to move to LA. My younger sister did keep the house running after my father's passing, but you know, it was tough, you know, the laws had changed and it was really tough. But that is really what happens to kids when you're coming from a family from a different era. And my dad, I mean, the cars that we drove, that's what I told somebody. They thought my dad was stealing money. And I just laughed and said, my dad is an Italian from the Bronx. A white convertible Cadillac lets everybody know we're just as good as you.
Yeah.
We're not poor. But I said to somebody, that's my college education. There's no savings for college. I had to get student loans to go to Santa Clara. Yeah. There was never any money. My dad was from a different era, and that's what it was. And so New York, I can't even begin to tell you. Uh-huh. So New York.
Well, there's so much more we could talk about.
No.
We're running out of time.
I'm sorry.
Because the book has a lot of your relationships, the residents in Milo Arms, some of them long-term residents, were part of mm-hmm. your family. And mm-hmm. and there was a lot of sorrow at some of the things that happened, and that your dad's whole approach seemed to be embracing and humanizing.
Thank you so much for really reading it and understanding at its core what I was trying to get at, and accepting the humor that I use without seeing it as pejorative. It is so appreciated. And I wanted to say thank you for having me on. And you just kind of have made my day.
I'm glad I could do that. And I think our listeners will also appreciate your frankness. A lot of humor in the book, just because I think that must have been the whole ethos of your family and of your dad's and your family's endeavors. And I want to encourage our readers, Surviving the Odd, Candy Milo, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Suzanne. Thank you.
Candy Milo, her memoir is Surviving the Odd. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.
Go! Live in a world where there's plenty. So how come we're running on empty? When we've been touched by so many, and still there's more without any, without any life.
Give a Little Love, sung by Tom Jones. I am Suzanne Lang. Laura Nemi is a professional storyteller who's worked in bars and in corporate settings and writes about, well, what it means to be human. In 2016, he received the National Storytelling Network's Lifetime Achievement Award, and we talked together about his book, A Breviary for the Lost, Poems from the During and After. A breviary is a liturgical prayer offered throughout the day. Nemi studied with the Christian Brothers for many years until they decided he could not be part of their community. Here's our conversation. Lauren, you are a storyteller and have been doing it professionally for most of your life, while also coaching others and writing. So before we get into your books, I'd like you to tell us about storytelling and how and where does one do this professionally, which you do, and how different is it from, say, being a stand-up comedian or a monologist, or maybe that is all rolled into what you do?
Here's what I'm going to start with, that storytelling is the fundamental way in which human beings organize data, organize thought, organize experience, and the way we pass it on from one person to another, or one generation to another, or one culture to another. Stories are the original kind of conveyors, the mother lode of arts, the history, politics, religion. How it differs from stand-up is that stand-up has a very narrow focus. How it differs from being a monologist is monologists can be storytellers, but oftentimes they think about themselves as being theater people. And the difference there is that in theater, one says the same thing every time. The script calls for X, and X is what you deliver. But when you're a storyteller, you're in the room with the audience and you respond to the audience. So even though I might have told the same story 100 times, there is inside the telling of that story differences, which are responsive to who the audience is, to where we are, to what I've learned, to how the story has shifted for me over the years from one telling or one situation to another. And I came to storytelling basically out of necessity. In the book, A Breviary for the Lost, there's a number of poems about the period of time when I was working with juvenile justice offenders. And when working with them, the traditional school system had failed them entirely. So oftentimes we resorted to telling stories to both hold their attention and to making particular points for them. So, once I started telling those stories, I became interested in expanding on them. More than just a story to make a point for a student. What does the story convey in and of itself? How does it speak to the larger culture? How does it speak to my experience or someone else's? Where is the delight of language? And what does the gift of that delight offer us?
There is a certain performance aspect to this as well, though. And when did you realize that you had a gift for this, or that it was something that you really did feel you could make your way in life doing?
I'm still discovering what I'm capable of in terms of storytelling, both who I can tell with, or who I can work with, or who can I be in the room with, and what is the nature of the stories that I'm telling. Over the years, it has shifted. When I began telling as a professional, like many storytellers do, I was working primarily in libraries, in schools. I was doing churches. I was telling traditional tales. And then a couple of things happened. In 1981, I was had a year of being the humanities scholar in residence in northern Minnesota, where I got paid good money to sit in bars and cafes and churches and do oral histories with people, collect oral histories, and comment on the culture that was in transition, that was moving from being largely industrial to being largely tourist and information services. And then in 1983, I had occasion to work with In Heart of the Beast Puppet and Mask Theater on the Circle of Water Circus Tour, which went from the headwaters of the Mississippi to New Orleans, the history of the Mississippi River, complete and total. And I served as both the ringmaster and the tour manager. Well, by the time that tour was done, the stories that had arisen during that tour became part of the repertoire of what I was telling.
Well, I want to get into your book of poems.
A Breviary for the Lost.
Poems from the During and After.
And After, yep.
I would say this is essentially the story of your life.
It is.
And though it is a book of poems, as it is read, there's this cumulative effect that identifies who you are. And you spent 7 years studying with the Christian Brothers to be part mm-hmm. of their religious community, but ultimately were rejected by them, and which seems to be a defining event for you, something you refer to as a great shadow in your life. And so before we get deeper into the structure of the book and what you're achieving there, talk about that foundational part of your life and your draw to the Christian Brothers and what that inability to take your final vows represented then and now to you.
I went to a Christian Brothers high school and I received a fabulous education. And I was impressed by the brothers who taught me. I was impressed by their intellectuality, by their dedication, by their spirit of what I perceived as a spirit of community. And I thought to myself, well, why not? It became clear that it would be a path to teaching, which is something I thought that I was capable of doing and wanting to do. And so I joined right out of high school. Started in a novitiate class of, I think there was 32 of us in the novitiate class at the beginning. And by time we went over to the scholasticate, we were down to 12 or 16. And by time I graduated from college, we were down to 8. Because one of the things that happened was the church was in turmoil. The church was post-Vatican II. Also, Vietnam was raging. So there was this undercurrent that went through the religious life of the church, and the order is changing too fast, or the church and the order is not changing fast enough. And that tension between holding on to the past, the stable structure of religious life, and recognizing that it was unresponsive and inappropriate to the needs of the time, grew and grew. You know, I was a member of a religious order, you know, poverty, chastity, obedience. I was good at one of them, and that was the one that got me thrown out. And indeed, I took the vow of poverty seriously. The work we were doing with the juvenile justice offenders, this was poverty work. We were working with the poor and the desperate. We were living in a farmhouse that had, you know, basically no insulation, a wood-burning stove, an outhouse, pump water. We were living on, you know, minimum wage and food stamps. And for myself and the other people who were there, Gregory and Michael, who are also brothers, this was the meaning of the vow. This was what we were called to do. The fact that it was not seen as what the order particularly wanted did result in my being denied final vows when I requested them.
Your experiences as a young man fully inform the writing here. And the structure of the book, which is a bit like a call and response in a way. You have poems that seem to be written at different periods of your life. And then your response or reaction maybe as the man you are now. That's how I was reacting to the form of the book. Also, then, this architecture of the breviary, of which is daily prayers that are part of the Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the book's structure and about your foundations there, because as I said, this is a book of poetry, but it does tell a story. So let's talk about that.
You know, it is as a breviary. It's broken into 8 sections. And each of the sections correspond with what would be the hours of prayer in the monastic life. There are poems in the first person on every page. And there is a chronology to them. They begin like the matin section, which is the first section of the breviary, is all when I'm in the novitiate, in the first year of formation. And then in the second section, we move to the scholasticate. And, you know, we move through basically my life in the order up until we get to... I think it's known. So in the first poem in the known section is at 50. And so the poems in the last section were written after leaving, after 25 years. But for all of the poems that are in the first person on the one side, there are footnotes. And the footnotes are on the other side, are all in the third person. Many of them were written indeed now, contemporarily, explaining or providing some kind of background or fleshing out some of the material from the poems. And some of them are in fact poems in and of themselves, which were written in response to times and places. So
you call them footnotes.
I call them footnotes. Yeah, I call them footnotes. Here's a poem, What It's Like. She said to me, death is a slow, seemingly inert predator, always just out of view, even when you know it's close, until it's too late, and all that's left is the shock of after. And then the footnote is number 57, right? And so on the other side, 50, the footnote is, when Baba Ram Das said, be here now, not even he knew how difficult it was to be, or what here meant, and certainly not the joy and terror of now. Those three little words are a lifetime of work to sidestep everything he was taught to value: status, race, religion, responsibility, obligation, and yes, desire. Most of all, the duality of a comfortable past and a promising future.
Well, I would say that a central theme of the book is finding peace, seeking peace, identifying peace. Both in that very public communal stage, but also in a personal way too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, I think for me, you know, after I left the order, you know, not by choice, it took me a long time to let go of anger, you know, and that 10 years after the fact, or 8 years after the fact, when I went, I was invited to come to the 200th anniversary of the Christian Brothers. And it was a big, big meal down in Winona at St. Mary's University. And I was sitting there and I was looking around the room and I thought the number of people who had been brothers and left outnumber the people who stayed. And I thought to myself, I can let go of anger. You know, all of these people are in this room because they want to celebrate the value of being in the world, you know, the value of fraternity, whether they are formal or informal in terms of their relationship to the order.
You also, during that early life, lived the life of an activist and were involved with the Catholic worker community as well. And I wonder if you have any observations about how activism has changed or waned or reformed or since the 1960s, when we still have a lot of the same, not even similar, but a lot of the same issues before us.
Oh, yeah. The past is not the past. One of the things I would say is that if I were to go in and spend some time with millennials, with Gen Xers, with people who are younger than me, and I would sort of scratch the surface a little bit, I could find what they are passionate about. And many of them would be the same things, and some of them would be different. But what happens is that I think for every generation, there is a realization that the world needs your engagement. And people look to find it, whether through a particular kind of activism. And what happens is that as we get older, we can recognize the activism that we knew, but we don't necessarily recognize the activism of those who came after us, who come to it from a different way. So as an example, in 1998, I was a Bush Leadership Fellow, and I went to Chicago to study the role of storytelling in community development. And it started me off on a course of 10 years of doing very heavily engaged in civic engagement, in training very poor people, immigrants, communities of color, as to how to engage in the political process, you know. And that activism was just as needed as anything I did in the 60s. Who I was doing it with might have been the same people, or might have been different, but the need of activism was still present. And what kinds of stories you needed to tell might, you know, shift it according to what the issues of the day are. So these days, issues of race, issues of gender, issues of women's right to autonomy, you know, these things are coming to the fore again. And the issue of activism for most people will get down to a very simple thing. It's will you or will you not vote? Will you or will you not vote for justice?
You also shared with me a book of short stories, What Haunts Us. And I'm imagining that these stories are maybe derived from or very similar to the stories you tell on stage.
Well, some of them are the same. You know, some of them have been told on stage many times before they ever made it into the book. But many of them are not. Ostensibly, you know, it is a collection of ghost stories in the largest sense of the word, ghost stories, not necessarily disembodied spirits, but in the sense of things which unnerve us and which we cannot quite come clear on. And, you know, since so we must explore the meaning of.
What is the difference in writing for the page and writing and preparing for a live performance, and maybe even the same piece? I don't know.
So when I'm writing for the page, because the page is fixed, you know, I can use language in a slightly different way. I'm allowed more of what I would call filigree in terms of what the words are, the structure of the is, because you can always go back and read it a second time. You can always look at it again if you didn't quite get it. Whereas when you're telling a story, what you have to do is you have to move the audience through the imaginative portion and the emotional portion of the story as you go. And so there is less opportunity for filigree and more the nuance of tonality, the how you say it, the speed with which you speak it, the volume with which you speak it counts a lot more in when you tell them. You know, it's when I'm teaching storytelling, the emotional arc of stories, you know, there are three different arcs. There's the arc of the characters in the story. What do they feel at any one period, and what do they say about, or how do they act on those feelings? There is the narration itself. There's how does the narrator feel about the story they're telling? And this is particularly true and particularly an interesting question you have to ask when people are telling their personal stories. If you tell a story about you as a younger person, are you sympathetic? Are you judgmental? Are you scornful? You know, are you telling it as a lesson learned, or are you holding it up as an example of naivete? Right? So the arc for the narrator becomes a really interesting one and a critical one, because it will help direct the audience to the third arc, which is themselves. And for the audience, the question is, it's like, where do you enter into the story? And those first sets of images, that first few minutes, you know, of where inviting an audience into a world so that if they were to close their eyes, they could see it and sort of ride, not only in terms of what happens, but their own feelings about how this connects to their life. How this, you know, do they recognize this as something familiar? And so by the end of it, you can get to something that is either, and you have to make a conscious choice, whether it's either something satisfying and, you know, we've wrapped it up, or somewhat disturbing and we've left it a little open-ended for the audience. And it's like, now you have to puzzle about this.
Lauren Neamy, a breviary for the lost poems from the during and after. Thank you for talking with us today and telling us about your work in life.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
My conversation with Lauren Neamy. His book is A Breviary for the Lost, Poems from the During and After. And we also mentioned his book of stories, What Haunts Us. Earlier, we heard from Candy Milo with her memoir, Surviving the Odd. Thank you, Candy and Lauren. I am Suzanne Lang, and I thank you for listening. We have production support from Will Penny and Mark Prell. We're a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Subscribe to our podcast and find past shows at krcb.org. Follow the program or podcast links for a novel idea. Give a